Welcome to the Inside Lacrosse Podcasts. I'm here with IL Indoor Editor Steven Stamp, the draft guru, as the NLL draft approaches just days away, 7 p.m. on Thursday. Steven Stamp is going to be on that broadcast. I think he's written about 20,000 words about the NLL draft in the past week. Steven, how you feeling?
Pretty good. I've been in it pretty deep, like you said. I did check my top 50 prospects came in at about 8,700 words. It may actually be around 20,000, I think. As you said that, I was like, oh, come on, that's an exaggeration. And I thought about it, I was like, that might be about right.
Well, no shortage of knowledge in any of those words, so please check out Stamper's top 50 prospects. We're going to have a mock draft coming up later this week on IL Indoor. But Stephen, this draft is, for lack of a better term, weird, as is everything during the COVID-19 pandemic. Just to kind of lay the base here, what are the rules in terms of eligibility for this draft?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little different this year, obviously. So as usual, any player who has reached the age of 21 or reaches the age of 21 this calendar year and has not played in an NCAA lacrosse is eligible for the draft. Mm-hmm. And the twist this year, of course, normally players who have graduated from college this year would go into the draft from college lacrosse programs. But this year, because of COVID, players have been given an extra year of eligibility to go back, as I'm sure everyone's aware at this point. So any of players who have finished 4 years of eligibility at an NCAA school on a lacrosse scholarship are in the draft, even if they are going back to school next year. So obviously those players would be taken by the team, they'd go back to school, and they wouldn't sign with the team. There's some pretty strict rules that are still working out about what teams are even allowed to say about or to players who are going back to school, and then they will become the team's property officially when they graduate or when they finish their year of eligibility next spring.
And that's huge, because the alternative of guys who, if you take out Jeff Teat, if you take out Ryan Smith, if you take out all these guys, it was going to be a pretty light draft, wouldn't you say?
It really was. I actually did one mock draft where I took out anyone who could have gone back for another year of university. So I even left out guys who had already said they weren't going to go back, they'd already graduated or whatever. And I mean, I had Curtis Conley as my number one pick and some other guys pretty high that I really like Curtis Conley. I've tried to make it very clear. I'm not denigrating Curtis Conley at all. I think he's very good, but he's probably not a first round pick. He might be at the end of the first round, but to have a player who may not go in the first round be the likely number one pick if all those guys weren't available, that's a huge impact. So, you look at all the guys who are likely to go to the first round, and a few more have come out. I mean, Marshall Palace declared fairly recently. It turns out Brad McCulley, who might go in the first round, he is available. Robert Hudson did finish at Vermont. So there's some guys, but it has a massive impact on the draft. And the big factor is when a team is picking a player, at what point is kind of a tipping point, right, where having a player available this year would overtake a bit of a difference maybe in how you have a player ranked. I think a good example is a Robert Hudson, who's very good. He's a very good player. I think he'd be a first rounder regardless of who's in the draft and who isn't. But if you're comparing him to a Ron John or Jordan Sturr, some of the other players, Connor McClellan, some of the guys who are close to him in the defender rankings, then do you take him ahead of those guys because he's available? Now, I think he might be ahead of those guys anyway. Where it really becomes interesting is, if a team really thinks they need somebody now, would you take him ahead of a Jeff Henrich or a Reed Bowron, who are, the consensus top defenders, transition players in the draft? And that's where it can get interesting. And it's how far down in the draft do you have to go before you reach that point where you say, hey, we really need somebody right now. And what teams does that affect? You think somebody like New York, for instance, that probably wants to get players who can play now because they want to get things rolling there. It was an expansion team that only won one game last year. they probably would like to get guys who can come in and start leading the change that they're trying to affect.
Yeah, so somewhere in the draft will be that tipping point, probably, where, you know, you're saying this guy isn't good enough, but like the guy who's immediately available is more valuable to me than the guy who might be a better player. Other thing that is a factor is just these guys haven't played lacrosse in a long time, and how are GMs handling this situation of, you know, some guys not evaluating them with their, you know, with their summer, and, you know, there's a lot of guys in your rankings that you have that you say he would have benefited tremendously showing his stuff in another summer. How are the GMs kind of handling those situations?
Kind of like all the rest of us. Look, I mean, they have more access and they've got their teams to talk with, you know, their coaches and their scouts and things, but you don't have the summer to evaluate. And it's such an important summer, the year before your draft, for a lot of guys. Now, I'll go back to Hudson as a good example of a guy who played his first year of senior in 2019, coming from the from Mimico Mountaineers, going up to the Brampton Excelsiors, and had a great summer, was a very good junior, and I think got better playing with better players, which some guys do. So I don't think it's really an issue for him. I think you've got a pretty good idea of what he can do, playing against man and playing at the highest level. Jeff Teat, obviously the same thing, where he played as a rookie in MSL in 2019. But for guys who were coming out and it would have been their first year in senior, that can be such an important year. If a player maybe is a bit smaller and you wonder how it's going to, you know, how the size will translate when he's up against bigger, stronger guys. If it's a player who's a big player and has kind of gotten by being the biggest, strongest guy, and now you want to see, well, when there's a bunch of other big, strong guys, can he still play the same way? You know, can you don't have that. If a player, I mean, somebody like Marshall Palace, who entered late, played Junior B, was going to play Junior A this year, and there were good reasons why he played Junior B. One of them, his brother was coaching the Wallaceburg team that he wanted to play for a year, and their other brother was playing for the team, so they all kind of got together for the summer. So there were reasons, but it doesn't change the fact that he hasn't played Junior A except for a few games. So he put up 151 points in the Junior B season, which is fantastic. He's brilliantly creative, extremely talented. What would it mean if he played Junior A? Luckily, we got to see him play in the President's Cup last year. I was there calling the game, so I got to see a lot of him. And I know he's really good, but it's still hard to make that projection. So it just means there's more guesswork, there's more projection instead of just evaluation. And I think that's the big thing. If you can't evaluate them playing at a certain level through the summer, you're projecting a little bit more, and there's not really much you can do to get around that.
When you look at a draft, everything we say before the draft, I don't want to say is meaningless. It's not meaningless. It's all conjecture. It's all projection. It's all guesswork to some extent. When you look at the draft order and how many picks certain teams have and what they need, do you feel like there's a team that's kind of lined up for success in this draft?
Wow, that's a great question, actually. I think the obvious answer would be Georgia, because they have four first-round picks. And obviously that's a huge advantage to have those. And they've worked at that, right? I mean, they've had a team philosophy of getting those picks and trading some picks down the line so they have picks when they need to use them. And they actually had the option this year of either using the number 10 pick from Toronto, which came in the Jason Noble trade, or for the second pick they're getting next year's first round. But they could have used the 2022 pick from Toronto, and Buffalo would have got that pick this year because they got it in the Mitch Disnew trade. So Georgia is very well positioned, and they actually do need some players because, you know, Alex Krepinsek left as a free agent. They traded Leo Sturris, so they've got a bit of a shortage on the back end now, and especially because Zed Williams was also traded in the direct trade that brought in Dan Coates to kind of replace Jason Noble. So maybe Brendan Bomberry slides up to forward to be the other ready forward, depending if they find someone they like in the draft. I don't know if Brian Cole stays up front. They had him playing largely forward last year. I think he's probably more effective out the back door, and I think they might like to move him back. So they need some guys. But they also have, I mean, Jordan Hall is getting a little bit older. They've got some guys who are getting older. So I'm sure they'd like to add some players who will come in a year. That's kind of a neat thing about the extra year of eligibility. Some players, some teams can kind of draft a guy, because so many times teams will draft a player and then don't really have a spot in their roster right now. And eventually you just have to let them go. You can try and keep them on the practice squad, but eventually you just, sometimes they just get cut and you wind up losing that player. This way you can kind of take somebody that you might need, say, a year down the road. So for Georgia, needing a lefty, they could look at someone like Marshall Paulus, who's available right away, or they can say, hey, we want a Tanner Cook or someone who's, not available for another year, Ethan Walker or someone like that, that would, then they kind of have that guy coming in next year, and they can plan around that, especially with expansion coming in. There's going to be an expansion draft for Fort Worth and possibly Las Vegas as well, because that's, in the works, potentially coming in the same year or maybe the year after. So, it gives them a chance with four picks, I think, to kind of mix it up. Maybe they get a couple of guys who are available now. I think Robert Hudson, again, is a great example who would really help them. And take some guys who are available in a year. Maybe Ron John would suit them, and he's going back to Albany for another year. So Georgia's in pretty good position. Colorado has three picks in the second round, as does New England have three now? There's a few teams that have multiple picks. You get a chance there. Now, Colorado doesn't have a first rounder, so that's a bit of a downside, but... I think Saskatchewan, of course, the other one who has – they don't necessarily need a ton of players right now, but they have a lot of players from that core that won all those championships that's getting older. Kyle Rubish, Chris Corbeil, Brian Dilks, a bunch of guys are all kind of getting into their 30s at the same time, and a bunch of them are going to be free agents. So they're going to need to replace guys. So I don't think they would mind if they got a couple of guys who would come in a year. And they have the number 7 and number 12 picks, so they're in a pretty good spot too.
This draft, a lot of the discussion has been about the guy at the top, Jeff Teat. I think you used the phrase generational talent when you talked about him in your prospect rankings. That phrase gets thrown around a lot, but why is it true for Jeff Teat?
It's funny, I just saw a tweet from Steve Gubbett, the president of San Diego, saying, if there's a generational player every couple of drafts, are they really generational? And I think it does get overused a bit. And I think Jeff Teat, I mean, his lacrosse IQ is just off the charts. And I like to point out that I was talking to his dad, Dan Teat, for a story a while ago, and he said, I would bring him to the games, and there was a lot of guys who would bring their kids to games. He said, but Jeff, he'd be on the floor and really engaged with the guys like John Tavares and Dan Dawson, or the different guys that he would be around in warm-ups and pre-games and that. But also, Dan said, when the games were on, other kids would be like running off to get popcorn or get a slushie or whatever, and Jeff would sit and watch the game and absorb everything he could. And he's been a lacrosse junkie and a real student of the game since he was 4 or 5. And it's worked. And you throw that in with his bloodline, the talent he inherited from his dad, who was a very good player as well. And it just combines to make him very special. I think there really hasn't been as clear a consensus number one pick as he is since Mark Matthews in 2012. So you're looking at 8 years, which is, not a generation in the genealogical sense, but it is. I mean, 8 years is close to a generation in lacrosse careers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Jeff Teat, getting to know his former Cornell coach, Pete Millman, a little bit. The work ethic is off the charts. Everything you'd want in a teammate, all that stuff is, as good as can get. He'll be returning to Cornell. It was a very much publicized kind of move to return to Cornell when there's a lot of confusion about the Ivy League, but he will be back given if there is a season in 2021 playing for Connor Busick, who was elevated to head coach there for the Big Red. So he's the clear number one. It's no question. It's the obvious choice. There's no way that anyone's name is going to get called before Jeff Teat's. Let's go through the top five, maybe not necessarily top five in terms of the order they're picked, But the guys that you have as your top five prospects, and we'll start with number two.
Sure. My number two is Ryan Smith from the Oakville Rock and Robert Morris University. And big righty forward, very talented, had just got better and better since he played Junior B. He was very good, scored, you know, 70 or 80 points or so. And then moved up to Junior A and got better, scored, you know, it was a 50-goal scorer, 100-point scorer, and was excellent with Burlington. Then in 2019, had his rookie season with Oakville, who protected him from the draft, and scored 22 goals, could have had quite a few more. I've talked to a bunch of people who watched a lot of the games. We all said, boy, Smith was snake bit early. He was hitting posts. He was hitting, just not scoring goals that he normally would, and started scoring later, and still had a great rookie season, and he's poised to be ready to go. Now, he is going back to RMU for another year, so it's going to be till 2022 before he comes out, but he's very talented, and a chance for him, I mean, if he does go second to Rochester, which I think he probably will, a chance to be a sidekick kind of to Sean Evans, who's 34 now and still obviously a very good player, but who knows how long someone in their mid-30s wants to keep playing or can't keep playing. I think he could slide into that number one role pretty seamlessly when the situation or the time arises.
Very good field player as well. Robert Morris is going to be a team to watch in this spring. They've basically got they've got a seventh-year player returning, so they have their attack line reunited from 3 years ago when they had a really good good run and almost beat Maryland in the NCAA tournament. So just an aside, keep a lookout for the Colonials this year in NCAA lacrosse. Then,
did you see a seventh-year player?
Yeah, so a guy you're familiar with is Adam Sherlambidis. He's going to be back for his seventh year at Rutgers. I believe he might even have an additional year still on the table. But Jimmy Perkins is a player at Robert Morris University. He is a walk-on. He was hurt his first 2 years. He played his junior year and senior year at Robert Morris, transferred to Utah, played a full year, then had the COVID-shortened year. So he's taking his extra year of eligibility back where he started at Robert Morris.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's, I never tried to do this because I had the knee injuries back-to-back and got the medical red shirts and will have completed a master's degree by the time he actually finishes his eligibility, which is a pretty good job of taking advantage of an opportunity in front of you.
Absolutely, and this guy, Jimmy Perkins, has got his undergrad, he got a master's out at Utah, and he's going to get an MBA at Robert Morris. So if there's a silver lining to all this, maybe some academic opportunities, kind of, these kids are taking better, I guess, shouldn't say kids, these guys are grown men, they've been in college for 7 years, they're taking advantage of. A team that's, an NCAA team that's no stranger to NLL talent, indoor talent, is Ohio State. So they have who you consider the third best player in this draft.
Yeah, Jeff Henrich is a terrific defender out of Orangeville. Was the first pick in the MSL draft last year by Coburg, but he actually went out west, as so many people do at some point when they're young players, went to the New Westminster Salmon Bellies. And that is a critical component in where he may be drafted. Because, you know, there's some Western guys that everyone's looking at for Vancouver Warriors, but there is a connection there with, you know, Dan Richardson being the GM or former GM of the Salmon Bellies and the GM of Vancouver. So that could lead to something there. But Henrich, very good defender, very tough, but smart, tough. I just think he's I really went back and forth with my three and four spots, but I landed on Henrich because he's just such a good shutdown defender, and he's got some pretty good transition chops too.
You know, I'm kind of hopping around a little bit here, but you had number seven, Trey LeClair, and you talked a little bit about how maybe people might be a little surprised about where his stock is. You didn't say it's any slight to him, but can you just explain your thought process behind him as the seventh best prospect?
Yeah, and I think I really want to explain that because he as a rookie, as a 17-year-old, he came into the BC Junior League, scored 40 goals, 104 points. He's rookie of the year. He was 6'1", 205, just a man among boys. And he was so strong and so good. Everyone thought, oh, this kid's going to come in. He's going to score 120 points a year, and he's going to, you know, be the best, and he's going to be the first pick in the 2020 draft. And he didn't really improve his production from there. I pointed out his points per game were 4.7 that year, his rookie year, 4.1 his next year, then 4.8 and 4.6. Very similar, right? So he didn't really take off from that point. I know Teddy Jenner likes to say that it's because the other teams in the league figured it out and put their top defenders on him. I kind of feel like even when he was in Delta before he went to New West, and you know, by the midway through his rookie year, people had a pretty good idea that he was good. And I think they were putting their top defenders on him. So I think it's more a question of plateauing. And sometimes when you come in and you're bigger and stronger and faster than everybody else, you know, you can do things. And then as people are catching up to you, or as, you know, people get used to that, maybe you don't necessarily improve from there because you have to figure out different things. I don't know he's figured those things out yet. I think he's probably got the ability to do it, but he hasn't necessarily done it yet. And I think it kind of makes him, it's had him drop a bit in my rankings. I think it's having him drop where he's going to get drafted. I don't think he's going to go in the first four players in this draft. And one thing I did point out, and I would encourage everyone, you know, go read the top 50 prospects. Well, I'll give you a précis about this because I took a look because it was in 2019, and, you know, there are people saying, oh, he's going to be one of the first two picks in the draft. Well, in 2019, he was on the second team all-star team in the BC Junior A League. And the four forwards who are on the first team were Ryan Martell, Denon Armstrong, Will Malcolm, and Zach McManus, all very good players. And the point I was making was Ryan Martell was taken 11th in the draft in 2017. Denon Armstrong was taken 30th in 2018. And then last year, Will Malcolm was taken 23rd and Zach McManus 27th. So listing Trey LeClair as the number seven prospect and saying he might be picked in the middle of the first round instead of the top is certainly not denigrating Trey LeClair. It's not saying he's not a good player. He's clearly a tremendous athlete and a very good player. He played on Canada's team at the World Field Lacrosse Championships in 2018, and that's a pretty tough team to make, right? So he's obviously very good. So I was trying to take some pains to point out that I don't mean any disrespect at putting him at number seven in my prospects list. I still think he's a very good player. I just think there's some guys who may have moved themselves a little bit ahead of him with what they've done in the last couple of years.
You've got a player next on your list who's someone that I love as a field player, and that's Reid Bowering. NCAA fans will know him for his work at Drexel, but you've described a ton of stuff he's done in box, and you've spoken so highly of him. Can you tell people what to expect from him at the next level?
Yeah, I mean, for one thing, does he play attack at Drexel? Or is he a middie?
He's an offensive player, we'll say that. You know, attack midfield, sometimes the lines get a little bit blurred, but he's definitely an offensive guy.
Yeah, right? Because he does have that ability to do different things. I thought he kind of moved around. And in box, it's kind of the same thing where he's not an offensive player. In box, he is a defender. He's been the BC Junior League Defender of the Year three times, who's named the top graduating player in 2019, his last season of junior. And he's a very good defender. He is very solid in the defensive zone, but he also has great transition ability. He can run the ball. May not score a ton, but he can score for sure. And he's very smart. And everyone raves about his leadership. And I haven't had the chance to be around in person close to teams that he's played for. So that part of it I'm having to take largely from what other people have told me, but everyone just talks about it. He's such a great leader. He's a captain everywhere he goes, and people assume he's going to become a captain in the NLL. So I think you combine that skill and athleticism with the leadership, and you have someone that people are very excited about getting into the National Lacrosse League.
And your number five prospect is the first guy who is potentially going to be, well, who's going to be available the upcoming NLL season. Marshall Palace, Six Nations Rebels, junior B player. Him being available right away, is it possible we see him maybe move up a few spots? How does that affect, you know, his draft status? And also, can you just tell us a little bit about him, particularly because, you know, some of the field fans might not be as familiar with him?
Yeah, because I mean, he really hasn't played field. He hasn't been in college at all, and he's just 20 this year. Would have another year of junior left, regardless. And now with the Ontario League saying they're going to move to a 22 and under format, he'd have a couple of years in junior. But he has played junior B, as I mentioned. He's going to play junior A this year with the Six Nations Arrows. And I don't know how it's going to affect his draft status. I've actually had some pushback on Palace as a really high-level prospect. Some people are saying, well, you know, he's too small. He's only played junior B. And the thing, he put up 151 points in the 2019 season, the regular season, put up another 108 points in the playoffs, which is just kind of mind-blowing. And then he went to the President's Cup and played with the Six Nations Rivermen, and he was the third leading scorer on the team. And I was there, like I said, calling the game, so I got to see Marshall play quite a bit in person. And he is wonderfully creative. He's so fluid. He's so smart with the ball. He does things. He makes passes that, for a lot of people, would honestly not be a good idea. But he kind of reminds me of Jeff Shatler in the way he'll come up with a play where he's just kind of going away from the play and will just kind of one-handed flip the ball up somewhere. And you're like, what are you doing? And then you see somebody just kind of happens to be there. He's incredibly talented and creative. With that Riverman team, there were games where he was definitely the best player on that team on offense. Warren Hill was the MVP of the tournament. He was fantastic in that. But Palace was the best forward for some of the games there. And that was on a team with his brother Johnny and with Zed Williams. And I'm sure all the, you know, the folks who are field first, folks are primarily field, know who Zed Williams is at this point, right? And I mean, Zed was great. There were times when Zed was the best player on the team, but Marshall was outstanding. And that really gave me a lot of confidence that he can play against men. I know it's only Senior B, but it is the best Senior B at the President's Cup. There are some really good teams. I mean, you know, just look at the list of some of the players who were in that tournament, who are in the President's Cup every year. I mean, he's out there shooting on guys like Aaron Bold, and of course Warren Hill was playing for them, and Brandon Miller. You know, they're very high level players in that tournament. So it gave me a lot of confidence in it. And I think honestly, 7 or 8 years ago, when I was really building my confidence and getting my prospect stuff really rolling in terms of how much coverage I do, I might have backed off and moved him down. I think I used to take a little bit more, put a little bit more stock in what other people said, sometimes over my own observations, but I'm very confident now in my ability to evaluate players. I've been doing it for a while, and I've been, you know, I've gotten to the point where I feel very confident when I see a player that I can figure out what he's got. And I think Marshall Palace has a real it factor. It may take him a little bit. I think he needs to put on some size and strength. He did. I messaged him a while ago, and he said he's 6 feet, 185 pounds. So I was like, well, that's pretty, you know, that's fairly solid. I think he does need to strengthen up a little bit. But, you know, like, I mean, Jeff Keats, not huge. There are other guys who have been very successful without being super big, because you avoid the big contact with intelligence and elusiveness. And I don't know. I think he's going to do some really special things, and he's a lot of fun to watch. It was fun watching him and Johnny playing together. Obviously, they haven't really had a chance to play together on teams, but I'm sure that they played in the backyard or something, because they looked really comfortable playing together, and that was pretty cool to see.
The lefty forward position, it's always extremely coveted. This draft, it seems like going way down the line, there's some really, really, really good lefty forwards out there. How deep is the position this year?
It's pretty wild when I looked at it, because normally they are coveted and they're kind of rare. More people shoot right-handed than left because it's kind of the natural way to shoot if you're right-handed is as a right, if you're a right-handed person, to shoot with the right hand at the top of the stick. Just like in hockey, you'd have the right hand at the bottom of the stick. But a lot of guys, especially in Canada, shoot the other way. I did a story about it for the magazine, Inside the Cross magazine, a few years ago, and talked to people and, you know, why do guys shoot left when they're right-handed? And I talked to Derek Keenan and Steve Govett and some others and got some pretty interesting looks from that and some ideas from that. But this year, there are 10 of the top 30 guys in my top 50 ranking are lefty forwards, which is kind of incredible. Four of my top 10 with Teat and Marshall Palace plus Tanner Cook and Ethan Walker. Throwing Brad McCulley and Ty Thompson. It is written. And Sam Firth, another guy. You look at just look at the Orangeville team from that won the Minto Cup last year, and you've got Ty Thompson and Sam Firth were both call-ups from Nepean, and they were affiliated players from the Nepean Knights who are really producing some good players. And they went to Orangeville and played key roles to the point where they actually wound up bumping Tanner Buck down. I mean, I've got Buck in my top 30 as well. Yeah, there's a lot of good lefties this year, and it's going to be interesting to see, you know, if teams are kind of stockpiling them a little bit, or, you know, maybe take a couple and see which one works out. It'll be fun to watch.
Certainly will be fun to watch. And some guys that I'm interested in, I'm sure a lot more of our podcast listeners are interested in, are some of the big NCAA names that aren't box players or are extremely limited in their box experience. I'm talking Michael Sowers, who is one of my favorite players I've ever covered in terms of just what he does on the field, but also just the kind of person he is. Brian Costable. We have Grant Amen. We have a lot of guys that you have somewhere sprinkled into these prospect rankings. What do you think of some of these guys? And, you know, are they legitimately potential NLL players who are going to make a difference in the league?
Yeah, and it's so hard to assess because if you haven't played box, you don't just step in. And honestly, I think Tom Schreiber almost did a disservice to other American college field players when he came in and was immediately, well, within a few games, got to be very good at box lacrosse because people think, oh, you know, Schreiber did it, other people can do it. Schreiber is very special. He everyone is not him, and it doesn't work out. Even Matt Rambo took a full season, really, to get the hang of it and then had a great second year in Philly. But he was a guy who, when you watched him on the field, it was almost like he was playing box on the field, right? Mm-hmm. He didn't shy from contact. Loved going inside. And I actually interviewed him on Boxelbeat, my podcast, and asked him about it. I said, you know, when your first games in the NLL, it looked like you were kind of going out of your way to be like rough and physical and edgy and kind of looked like he was taking you out of your game. He was like, yeah, I wanted to get in there and show them I could play in the inside, play in the box. And it did take him out of his game a bit, but he figured it out pretty quickly. And he obviously had a great season last year. You have to look and see, okay, who do you think, how do their traits carry over? How can you adjust them? I like Michael Sowers, you mentioned. I mean, he's unbelievable to watch, right? Like, what an athlete, just a tremendous talent. And like you said, just seems like a great guy. I don't know him personally, but everything I hear about him and see from him just seems pretty amazing. Now, I really like the way he sees the field and the way he can touch. He can touch pass. He can be very precise when there is defensive pressure. When spaces do close down, he doesn't seem to need to clear out. He doesn't seem to need to back away. He can keep attacking. And I think that bodes pretty well. Now, he's, you know, a Princeton guy. He's going to Duke. He may have some great opportunities outside of playing in the NLL, and that is another thing you have to look at. You know, these guys who go to good schools, and, you know, guys who go to Ivy Leagues or whatever, or, you know, Brian Costable at Notre Dame, that can lead to some pretty great opportunities. Everyone thinks that John Arlotta is going to draft Brian Costable. And I've heard people say, oh, they're going to take him in the first round with the 13th pick. It's possible. I don't know. I don't think so. And I think it's because he has a great job. And I don't know, and I'm not sure if teams know, if he wants to play in the NLL. His game certainly looks like it would translate. He'd be a defensive transition player in the NLL, most likely. And he certainly looks like he's got the athleticism and the defensive mindset that could translate. Grant Ament, again, the way he turns on a dime, the way he's so agile and can handle traffic. Again, traffic is such an important part of it that, you know, maybe he can adjust to, but that's another one where, when do you take a player like that when you've got a kid who's been playing boxes across since he was 4 years old, has no adjustment period to the game, it'll just be to the higher level, and is pretty ready to go and play at the NLL level, whereas somebody like a Grant Ament, what's the adjustment period going to be? How long will it take him? Do you have time to wait for him to figure that out? So at what point does it become worth that? Does it shift? It's kind of like the, is a guy available this year or not until the year after? Same thing. How much does his potential and how, what you see him possibly being, when does that outweigh a kid who already knows how to play box across and is also very good, and you're going to be able to just kind of step in and introduce your systems rather than having to teach them to play the game?
Yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, why these guys do their job. It's a tough job to do and project all this out. But every guy you mentioned is clearly a great talent, and at least outside. And, you know, from my perspective, covering these guys, have the work ethic, have the drive, have the IQ to probably pick it up. But it's just a matter of, you know, how much is that worth waiting for versus the sure mm-hmm. thing who might not be as much of a high ceiling as these guys do if they kind of get to their full potential. The
guys, more floor, but probably maybe a higher ceiling, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the dilemma.
So yeah, Stephen, we started this up, and I think one of the first things I said is this is a weird draft. It's been a weird year in every aspect. Obviously, the NLL season got shut down the same time the NCAA did and everything else, and, you know, weren't able to finish it out. What chatter, what discussion have you heard about, you know, getting back to play 2021 season? Pro leagues are doing their thing right now with, you know, with some success in terms of the NFL so far. The pro outdoor lacrosse leagues did kind of these quarantined tournaments that obviously wouldn't really work for NLL's model. What have you heard they're thinking about?
Yeah, I know the NLL was discussing the possibility of doing a bubble for a playoff. You know, some kind of go somewhere for a couple of weekends and do it to wrap up the 2020 season. And it just didn't happen. They ended up realizing that because it was earlier in the year, there so much of COVID was still so uncertain, right? Not that it's not still. So for 2021, obviously the key difference with the NBA, the NHL, the NFL is they can have a season without fans. They kind of need to have a season without fans if they can't have fans, because they have TV contracts that pay a massive proportion of their revenue. And the NLL does not have that. So the National Lacrosse League needs to have fans if they're going to do a season. So it does make it a bit different. I mean, the NFL, Kansas City had 1/6 of their stadium or so was full. They had little groups of season ticket holders that were, you know, isolated together, or were family, were in each other's bubbles. So you'd have like 5 or 6 people sitting together and then space around them. I know the Miami Dolphins are planning to do the same. Jacksonville had some fans, but nobody else on opening weekend had fans. But again, you know, you have teams bringing in $300 million a year each, or whatever it is, from TV revenue, and you can do that. The NLL needs for things to be a bit back more to normal. I know they're not going to plan to start until at least January, and they have been working on contingencies to start in February or in March. So they really have to wait and see, play it by ear, right, and see how everything plays out and how the other pro leagues do fare, and how that could translate to indoor. Because again, they can't do a bubble for a full season. You can't be like, okay, isolate yourself away from your family and your jobs, you know, your day jobs, because these guys aren't full-time athletes. You can't say, you know, leave that all for 4 months and go be in a bubble. So it is very challenging. I think there's a lot of optimism and a lot of everyone's just working on positive ideas and things they might be able to do. But there's also the reality that, you know, maybe there isn't a season. I don't even like to say it because it's been very hard this year on everybody, obviously. And I am well aware, and I totally get that there are things way more important than sports. And I'm fully cognizant of that, and I'm not going to complain when there are people dealing with much more serious issues. But for those of us for whom lacrosse and the NLL is a very important part of our lives, it's been tough, right, to be without it. And no summer lacrosse affects more than just not being able to evaluate prospects. I mean, I would normally be out calling. I called 27 regular season games in major series lacrosse last summer in the 2 month regular season, and then did playoffs. So it's such a big part of my life. And if the NLL couldn't go, I think it would be, I mean, it'd be devastating in a way. But so I think they're really just hoping that they can figure it out, and hoping the fans will be able to be back. But it's harder when you're in arenas instead of stadiums, right? Being outdoors helps with that. So I guess the short answer would be they're working on contingencies for as many possibilities as they can think of to try to make a season work.
And potentially a season that is unlike any other in terms of, you mentioned starting in March or February or something like that. So I guess it's not be surprised if something outside the box comes out, and that's what we do for NLL 2021.
Yeah, just and be prepared to adapt and adjust as things go. I mean, you know, we don't know what it's going to look like in a few weeks or in a few months. So whatever plans are being made are probably going to change. You know, you have to prepare for whatever you can, but also be ready to adjust whatever you've prepared for.
Prepare for what you can. You're the most prepared man in the business. You're going to be on the draft broadcast on Thursday. What's going to be your role, and what can people expect out of you covering this draft? You know, it's going to be broadcast on a number of places, whether it's going to be the NLL's Facebook, the YouTube channel, Bleacher Report Live. So your face is going to be all over. What can we expect from you?
Yeah, and it's going to be on BR. All six rounds will be on BR Live, by the way, whereas on the Facebook and that, it'll just be the first three rounds. So I would encourage everyone to be prepared for that. If you like to watch on Facebook or YouTube, whatever, be prepared to switch over if you want to see the last three rounds. So we'll have Devin Caney hosting again. She took on that role last year, and she has just really grown into her role, I think, by leaps and bounds this year, really gotten comfortable with what she's doing and is doing, putting out a lot of good material. Like, really, you can just see her familiarity and comfort level rising, which I think is pretty cool. And she'll be hosting Teddy Jenner, who came on last year, and I will be the analyst. So basically, because it's a virtual draft, I mean, we're setting up. They sent us a kit, the league did, that has the broadcast company did, that has a ring light, and there's an iPhone 11 that I guess is one of the newer ones, and it, I don't have an iPhone, so I'm not familiar with them really, but it like mounts in or on top of the ring light. And then we have to have another device that we can connect as an intercom. We've got a bunch of different wires. We have to set it all up. We have testing on Tuesday to make sure it's all working. They're putting so much effort into making this virtual draft work. It's, you know, Kate Productions are just, it's pretty amazing, you know, under Joel Feld and Scott Zelvatoro and guys are putting a ton of work in to making this whole thing work. It's still going to be, they've told us, be prepared to, you know, adjust on the fly. They're going to have the GMs or a representative, not all GMs, a rep from each team will be in with the same kind of kit, and we'll be announcing them. Picks, and so we'll be seeing them. I guess Devin, Teddy, and I we've been told we have to be prepared to be on camera at all times. Now, the draft takes about 5 hours, so we are going to, I assume, we're going to be able to, you know, step out to go to the bathroom, or I have a bit of a back issue. I have to stand up every half hour or so. So, you know, if you're watching and you see me standing up, it's just a stretch a bit. But, yeah, we're going to be giving analysis, Teddy and I, of all the picks, and just looking at, hey, what did we expect this team to do? Do we think this is a good pick? Why would they take this guy? You know, what can you expect from him? How's it going to work? What surprises are there? We'll just be doing a lot of talk about it. And we've got Tabitha Turner is on to do interviews again, and she'll be talking to some of the players. I know some of the players will be connected and doing virtual interviews with Tabitha after they get selected. We've got, I think there are some surprise guests who will be talking. Some, I don't know if it's other announcers or other analysts. I don't actually know who they are yet. I think they're kind of keeping that to surprise even us. But they're going to be on for, because teams can take timeouts. So, you know, there'll be somebody for Tabitha to talk to while those are happening sometimes. And they're recording some interviews with some folks. And so there's going to be a lot of good content. It's going to be very, I don't really like that word content in the terms of, I don't know, there's going to be good material that we're presenting and sharing. And I think it's going to be very unusual. I think it's going to be fun. I think in some ways, because we're all going to be connected, we're all going to be able to hear each other. And, you know, it's, and the guys have worked so hard. I can't emphasize enough how much work the broadcast crew has put into making this happen. I think it's going to go pretty smoothly for the folks watching. I don't know if it'll be as vastly different once they get going and familiar with it as you might expect. I think for those of us who are used to being, you know, in Toronto or Philadelphia, wherever the draft is, and sitting with each other and talking and being able to do, you know, poke each other if we need to get attention or something, it's going to be more different for us. And I'm not going to complain, because I'm just thrilled that they put this work in and we're able to have the draft. But it is going to be pretty weird sitting in my home office on my own looking at an iPhone for 5 hours to do the draft.
Well, we're all looking forward to it. You know, like I said, you're extremely prepared. You can basically see all of Steven's preparation on ilindoor.com right now. Tons of stuff that you've put together. It's really awesome stuff. So everyone should go and read that first and foremost. And, you know, check out the draft. Even if you're not a, you know, current NLL fan, if you're someone who's just kind of learning about these players and learning about this league, check it out. And we're hopefully going to be back on the floor soon.
Yeah, I hope so. And thanks so much for the kind words. I do put a lot of time and effort into it. And every year, honestly, I think, wow, I forget just how much the draft kind of consumes me. But I love it. I mean, I've gotten really into it. And I appreciate the promotion. And I hope everyone checks it out and enjoys it. And read everything, watch the draft, and have fun. And feel free to hit me up on Twitter if you have any comments or questions. Or I know a few people have already. And it's cool. It's a lot of fun. I keep saying that, but it is. I think this whole thing's a lot of fun.